All right. Thanks for your patience, folks on Zoom. This is our first full Sunday trying to do the hybrid session. Would you change that to gallery view? All right. So I will go around and greet people, starting with the folks on Zoom and then the people in the Zendo. So hello to Bob and Tyler, Jane, Aaron, Linda, R, that is, Claudia, welcome back, Claudia, Mark, Paulette, Karen, Marv, Vin, Andy, Kemyo, Michael, Sabrina, Grant, nice to see you again, Grant, Betty, and Ruth Ann. And then in the Zendo, we have Linda B. and Jinryu, Jim, Katie, sorry, I know, something that went through my head was that, wait a second, what we used to do in the Zendo was have people say their own names and we would repeat it. So I'm like, wait a second, anyway, Alice, Erica, and James. So let's see. We keep on. So let's see. So I think, Bob, I don't think you need to spotlight me, right? Because if people go on speaker view, I will get big, right? Because if you spotlight, then it changes our view in the Zendo and we have to adjust it. So if you, what I recommend is if you are on Zoom, that you might want to opt for speaker view, which is a setting that you can do up at the top of your screen. There's gallery view shows everybody, but then I'm a tiny little box when I'm talking. So if you want to, you can choose speaker view and then whoever is speaking will get enlarged on your screen. All right. Again, apologies as we get the tech all working. It's really nice to be here in our Zendo. Let's see, what do we have coming up? We have a one-day retreat on Saturday, November 13th. So that's like 2 weeks from yesterday, I believe. And we will have an in-person component to it as well as the online component to it. So if you're interested, check the newsletter, check the website. And if you want to participate in person, you need to register. If you are online, registration is optional, but you might want to register just to let us know what you're going to do. Part-time participation is fine. Let's see. If you're interested in volunteering, there are now all kinds of volunteer jobs available. Mark is coordinating the Zoom hosts and the Zoom greeters. Those are people who are online. And in the Zendo, we need people to open the Zendo and people to greet people and check and see if you're on the all clear list. And we also have a rota of Zendo cleaners that come at other times. And what we are going to need in the Zendo as well, if anybody is intrigued and kind of geeky, we do need a Zoom tech. So James is doing that today, but basically somebody to help just babysit the Zoom connection in the Zendo, you know, move the camera like you did during the ceremony to give a better view, make sure the audio is turned up and all that. Yeah. Any?
I will offer training and extensive job aids. If anybody's scared, it's not really that difficult.
Okay, cool. So yeah, James said he'll help train people, and then there'll be step-by-step instructions as well for how to do that. All right. Anything else, anybody? Any questions or anything, any other announcements I should make? Okay. So, feels really weird to be in here without a mask. All right. Okay. So today's Dharma talk, I'm calling a brief intro to Making Peace with Ghosts, Unresolved Karma, and the Sajiki Festival. So just to clarify, we have always called this Sagaki. Gaki means hungry ghost. But we're trying to switch over to call it Sajiki, and apparently that's something the Sōdasshū in Japan is doing. I believe Gakis, like hungry ghost, was used as a pejorative term for certain kinds of immigrants in Japan, so that, you know, in kind of modern sensitivity, they're trying to get away from using that term around the ceremony. So Sajiki, okay. But it's, if you hear me say Sagaki, it's just because I'm not used to using the term Sajiki. We did, for those of you who weren't here earlier, we did our annual Sajiki ceremony, which, I'll show you here. So we have a fancy altar that, I don't know if you can see, there's Kit Kats on the altar, there were donuts on the altar, and all of our Buddha images, that's the main altar behind, have been covered up with cloth. And I will explain all of that in a little bit. I'm going to talk about our festival, but also kind of the teaching behind it. First, I wanted to share our lineage. So this is about our lineage mythology around the story behind this ceremony and why we do it. And I'm going to share it because of the richness of the imagery. And so some of what I'm going to say, like, sounds like I think there's a realm of the hungry ghosts and that ghosts are real and that, but it just, you know, maybe you believe in that, maybe you don't, that's not necessary. But it's the richness of the mythology, which speaks to us at a non-intellectual level. I was thinking just about how this is, there's two extremes. One, you might say, you know, literal belief in ghosts or supernatural things. And then on the other end of the spectrum is just, it's just metaphorical. But the reality is more a liminal place in between, where the metaphor is not exactly literally true, but it points to something that is true, that is difficult to get across in some, you know, pure prose. So that's why I'm sharing all of this. So you don't have to buy any of it. You don't have to think, you know, that hungry ghosts are going to come in through the open door and partake of the stuff on the altar. But Buddhism has plenty of room for whatever you want to believe. So let's see. So we celebrate this once a year. On the Sōdasshū website, the Japanese Soto school website, it says it's a ceremony to comfort the ancestral spirits. And it is listed next to Obon, which is like, essentially, this is a, there's a religious Buddhist ceremony that would be traditionally done, you know, in the monastery, a bunch of monks at a temple. But then there's also a larger cultural tradition that has sprung up around this. So in Japan, it's Obon, and in China and Korea, and so in China, it's Ghost Month. I'm not sure what it's called in Chinese, but there's a ghost festival as well around this. So similarly, it's that idea, which seems to be pretty widespread. Certainly we have it in the West, that at around this time of year, the boundaries between the realm of the living and the realm of the dead become more permeable, and maybe ghosts come over, and or maybe there's, you know, a communication possible or an offering possible or something. So during that time, you honor your deceased ancestors, which are said to be able to come out of the lower realm and visit the living. And offerings are made, food, celebration, music. So I was just reading today online. So I don't have great personal experience of this, but there will be like celebrations and shows that are really loud in order to attract the ghosts. And that sometimes the front row of seats are left empty for the ghosts. So it's this sense of, you know, inviting the dead. Yeah, and then usually then there's a closing to the festival, whether it's a few days or a couple weeks, where you send the spirits back home. And sometimes it's done with those, you light a candle and put it in a little boat and put it on the river. So that's like, now you're sending them back to the realm of the dead. So our religious festival in particular springs from a story in our old sutra, the story of Moggallana. Moggallana is another version of his name, and then Mulian, I think, is it in China, version of the name. So he was a disciple of the Buddha, one of the main disciples, and he was supposedly had great psychic powers. Again, not that they mattered, it wasn't necessary to realizing Buddhism, but he used them in his teaching. He made use of them when he could. And one of the things with his psychic power let him travel to the realm of the hungry ghosts, travel to other realms and speak to the beings there. So let me, now I gotta fill you in on the six realms, which some of you are familiar with, but this is Buddhist cosmology. So again, this is, I mean, I don't believe in it literally. Some people certainly did and do that, you know, when you die, you are reborn and you go into one of these realms. I think of it as more metaphorical, but again, it's not just metaphorical, you know, it points to something important. So in the Buddhist cosmology, there's not just heaven or hell, or even heaven, hell, and purgatory. There are six realms. So there's a heaven and there's a hell. And the hell is, you know, really bad. It's described as vividly as the Christian hells. But then there's also the human realm, the realm of the fighting demigods. So that realm, they're very near heaven and they can see all the great stuff in heaven and they're so envious. So their lives are just, you know, they're just compulsively jealous and competitive and trying to get the stuff from heaven. And then there's the realm of the beasts, which are just kind of out for like, you know, food, sleep, sex, kind of just a very self-centered, small-minded, and not very attentive to karma. And then the hell realm is terrible. The hungry ghost realm, in this realm, the beings are reborn there. So you're reborn in these different realms for different reasons. You're reborn in heaven if you were a good person, but also because of spiritual practice. So there's spiritual aspects to heaven. The hungry ghost realm is you're reborn there when you have been, I guess, really stingy is the best way to describe it. And each of these realms, it's like you get reborn in that realm, not just if once upon a time you were stingy, but you kind of made a way of being stingy in your life and kind of conniving to get more. So beings are reborn there then. Extreme selfishness, greed, feverish angst. And in the ghost realm, they're not tortured quite like people in hell, but they cannot find sustenance. They're searching, some of them are searching for food and drink, they never find it. Or when they find it, they're almost there and then an army of guys comes out and cuts them to pieces so they can't get to it. Or they get to it and it turns to fire or it turns to coal or something and they can't eat it. And then there's other ghosts that are envisioned as having really tiny mouths so they can't get the food in, a really tiny throat so they can't swallow it, and they've got big distended bellies from hunger, and so they can't take the food in even if they find it. And then there's other ghosts who are, or hungry ghosts who are a little bit more like Western versions of ghosts. They're just kind of stuck on past karma, and they drift here and there and cause trouble and, you know, visit others, relive their death over and over, things like that. So Mogalana, he has these psychic powers, so he wants to see where his parents who have passed away have ended up. And he finds out that his father is in heaven, but his mother ended up in the realm of the hungry ghosts. So he's very sad and upset, and he tries to offer her some, because he can travel there, he tries to offer her some food, but it just turns to coal. Like, because she's in the realm of the hungry ghosts, she can't take it in. So he wants to help her, and he talks to the Buddha about it, and the Buddha says, essentially, the only way that she can receive some sustenance is an offering of the devoted. And the best thing to do would be to make an offering to the Sangha, and then the Sangha will dedicate the merit to the hungry ghosts, to the deceased parents or whatever. So there's an acknowledgement that if we make this offering in community, if we make this offering as a Sangha, it will have more efficacy, which is why this evolved into like a cultural wide ceremony, that a time of year where we want to come together and make these offerings, not just individually. So there's many different stories, but apparently Mogalana's efforts, they don't free his mom right away. She's reborn again. She's reborn as a black dog. There's some very colorful stories, and she's reborn as a black dog, and Mogalana is talking to her, and she says, well, really, this isn't as bad as it was before, because at least I can eat garbage and drink from puddles and stuff like that. So eventually then she's reborn as a human and has a chance for spiritual liberation. So in terms of ghosts, obviously there's different ways to interpret what this is. There's, as I mentioned, there's honoring ancestors, spirits fondly remembering, making offerings with the wish that they are, you know, in a good place, that they're not in the hungry ghost realm, to just honor their memory. And there's an important aspect to this, but I'm not really going to be talking about that part today. And then we're not really talking about supernatural ghosts. I'm totally agnostic when it comes to that. I know people who said they have experience with ghosts. I have not, so I can't say So it's not about that. It's not about the supernatural aspect, but the metaphorical aspect. But then again, keeping in mind that it's not just metaphor. So the lines between those kind of blur. So in the sense that we're talking about it, ghosts or unresolved karma. Generally, this is something from the past that is lingering in an unhelpful, unhealthy way. I mean, and that's not the only cultural interpretation of spirit. Sometimes the spirit is beneficial or neutral or something, but ghosts, as we're thinking about them, are like, there's some karma and negativity there. So unresolved karma. So karma is the law of cause and effect as it applies to behavior, as it applies mostly to willful choices that we make. So if you treat everybody around you like crap, you're not going to have very good relationships, that kind of thing. You know, it's like there is a cause and effect to, you know, how you behave and what happens. So unresolved karma is like the causes, there's things appearing in the present that are due to stuff that like you did in the past, but also what other people might have done in the past. And this is something new in Buddhism. Traditionally, it primarily just focuses on your actions. And so there's some kind of extreme traditions will even say, whatever happens to you in this life, it's due to something you did in a past life, if not this one, which I think is bullshit, but you know, so one of the things that we've added to I think the understanding of Buddhism is the idea of collective karma. We're not just affected by our own individual actions, we're affected by other people's actions and the actions we're culpable for because we're part of a culture or we're part of a family. You know, there's actions we don't just take in isolation, there's actions we take together. So in that sense, you know, we may have ghosts or unresolved karma that aren't just about, you know, what we did. It might be somebody else or something cultural, but it usually has to do with human behavior and choices have resulted in, you know, regret, hurt, loss, disappointment, resentment, reactivity, sadness. And sometimes this unresolved stuff is kind of associated with a person, you know, so it can feel pretty vividly like this person, if they have passed away, is kind of haunting you. They're still present in a visceral kind of way because of what they did, in particular your relationship, or maybe they're still alive and it's unsaid things, it's unresolved things, they've hurt you or you have hurt them or something like that. So sometimes it is associated with a person, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's just more of a reactivity. And as we contemplate that idea of this unresolved stuff of being associated with a person, and particularly if a person passes away, and there's this kind of a sense, you know, we might say that their ghost remains. The useful question is, when we die, are we going to linger as ghosts? And again, it's not necessarily as in a supernatural way, but if you leave, you know, a wake behind you of hurt and unresolved things, you know, the impact of you is going to be around in a negative way for a while, even after you're gone. So in some ways, this is an interesting way to think about our own lives and what, you know, what kind of life we want to lead so that we don't end up in the hungry ghost realm, whether ourselves or other people experiencing us that way. And I think something remains a ghost when it's not quite ready to leave us. And in terms of practice, that means we're not quite ready to let go and heal, or we don't yet see how that can happen. We don't know how yet. So there remains this stickiness, there remains this inhibition, there remains this sadness or this fear that, you know, you can't quite get rid of. So our Tsujiki ceremony enacts physically what we want to be doing in our practice. So that's what a lot of our ceremony is. It's just a very simple physical reenactment of what we want to be doing in our minds and hearts. So, you know, here we are, we've covered our Buddha images, we've set up the altar with junk food, made an offering they can accept, we open the door, we make a big racket and call them in. And then the doshi, the priest goes up and makes these gestures to open this gate between the realms. And as you go up, you put your fist over your kidney to, like, as kind of a protective gesture that, you know, like, you can come, but there's going to be some boundaries here, okay? So, like, you can't just wreak havoc here. So we invite you in. We've done this protective thing. And we make the offerings, and then at the end, we send the ghost back. So there's a space created for this invitation. And traditionally, so like at Dharma Rain, and maybe someday here as well, We did a Sajiki retreat, starting like Friday evening and until Sunday. And we would acknowledge that the whole weekend was about inviting these ghosts to be present with us. And then on Sunday night, it ends with a Sagaki Toro festival where we would write down something on a slip of paper we wanted to let go of and put it in the fire to kind of call it all to a close. And I thought about it in the retreat, and there was other times we can do this, of course, but in this retreat, I kind of thought about it as I'm sitting Zazen, trying to consciously open the doors of my mind, you know, imagining the Zendo doors open. Okie dokie, come on in. And so this consciousness of just like opening the doors of the mind and being like, all right, I know you're there, you know, like letting this stuff in, which is not necessarily pleasant. And then what we do is we just sit with it. We make whatever offerings we can to it. We sit with it. We're not trying to chase them away. We're bearing witness. And then at some point we say, okay, well, we've got to get on with things. And we don't know, but when we reflect in this way, we don't need to go searching for ghosts. You know, you don't need to go through your mental laundry and try to find something that hurts, but just an openness to it, that it'll arise when it's appropriate. And then we don't know what's gonna happen. Like Mogalana, we don't know when this ghost is gonna be ready for the Dharma. We keep, you know, just we stay in contact with it, invite it in, see what Dharma we can offer. At Dharma Rain, we had a children's program, and they would be part of Sogaki. So the adults would do their ceremony. And then the kids would come in and they'd start doing some chanting. And then, so there's little kids and the middle schoolers, several middle schoolers would be dressed up as Gakis. And they'd come crash the party in the middle of the chanting. And they would come in and they would come in with their shoes on and they would just start pulling stuff off the altar. And they would, and so the chanting stops and, you know, and we say to the kids, like, you know, maybe we should teach the Gakis how to take their shoes off, you know, and they'd go over and they'd be really stupid and they'd learn how to take their shoes off. And we'd teach them how to bow, and the middle schoolers would act like it was really hard. And then like they have just little holes for mouths, so the kids would like, you know, stuff a Kit Kat through the hole so that the Gaki could eat, you know, and then we'd say, okay, now it's time for the Gakis to leave. But, you know, the teaching that we gave to the kids was that, all right, you know, they're here for the candy, but maybe we can teach them just a little bit before they go. So in a way, that's, you know, again, it's an enactment of what we want to do with these ghosts of ours. Just, it's probably not going to be fruitful to just try to get rid of them, fix them, make them go away. They're here with us if we acknowledge them, but we invite them in from time to time and see what Dharma they can accept on their way. So just to share this kind of experience of like, you know, is it just metaphor? Is it real? My experience, one of my most powerful experiences of Sajiki was early on in my monastic training. And I had become ordained as a monk, and my parents, my father in particular, really was not thrilled about that. He did not spend tens of thousands of dollars on my college education so I could just like go just, you know, throw it all away at some kind of weird religious cult. So, and my family, you know, they thought it was extreme. It was fine that I was a Buddhist, but they just thought this whole monastic thing was really extreme. They didn't get it. And so it was a rough few years of just feeling really alienated from them. And I wanted them to understand, but my sister actually was the one who was like, you know, please stop trying to explain or rationalize this. We don't care. We care about you. all we care about is our relationship with you. We don't, you know, don't give a crap about Buddhism. So anyway, I was at Sajiki and just, you know, having gone through the retreat. And during the ceremony where we were walking around and chanting, I just had this sense that my grandfather, who had passed away a couple years earlier, quite a lot earlier, was there. And he was in a good place. He had been a devout Catholic, and he was checking out what I was doing, you know? And he was there, and he was like, he understood. He understood. He like, oh yeah, that I get that. And like, it healed something in me. I did not need anybody else in my family to ever affirm what I was doing again. It's like, well, grandpa understands. So, you know, you never know what is going to happen when we explore this stuff. So, in making peace, we just sit with what comes up. We don't aim to chase it away. We bear witness. We make an offering. We don't know how long this ghost might linger, when it will be freed. So it's a willingness to witness and if possible, understand what this ghost wants. Why are they lingering? Why is this still here? But as anybody who, you know, has worked with kids or whatever, what the ghost wants is not necessarily what it needs. So the ghost may want candy. We know the ghost really needs Dharma. So the ghost may want affirmation, or the ghost may want control or guarantee or whatever. And we can acknowledge that is what the ghost wants. Okay, you know, and be compassionate about that, but also recognize that's not really gonna nourish. That's not really gonna free the ghost. So I always like to say that hungry ghosts are like, they're looking for love in all the wrong places. They don't know how to really find satisfaction. They're just, you know, looking for this and that doesn't actually satisfy. So then we can hold out that question about what does the ghost really need? Perhaps it's acceptance, forgiveness, recognizing delusion, recognizing our freedom, you know, just maturation and growth. But it's the nature of ghosts that they may not be ready. And then they just, we're still haunted for a while. And we cultivate patience with these ghosts and keep making the offerings. So I will leave it there, and let's see. Now that we open it up to comments and questions, those in the Zendo won't be able to be heard unless you use that mic. So if anybody want the handheld mic, well, okay. Yeah, so those on Zoom, Bob, I'll look to you. If somebody's asking a question in the Zendo and you can't hear them, you know, go like this, and we'll give them the handheld microphone. So those are who are on Zoom, if you wanna ask a question, you know, raise your hand using the Zoom raise hand feature, or if that doesn't work, just physically raise your hand or unmute yourself. And to people in the Zendo too. I was hoping that people might have be willing to share examples of ghosts, the metaphorical kind. You know, that things that you have realized just linger and stay with you and are hard to let go of. If you're willing to share, and or any stories of being able to find some kind of resolution, let this thing go. Paulette?
So, Mia, I'm just curious if this is going to be available as a podcast, because I've heard some of this and some of it I missed because there's a bunch of kids screaming outside my place. So I just want to be able to listen to it again.
Yeah. That was my plan. The question is, you know, how quickly, because it's kind of a timely thing, right? It needs to happen. So it probably should be the next episode if they do it.
Thank you.
I'll both offer a story and test the audio. A little soft, eh? All right.
Can you hear Bob?
Yeah.
No, not very much. Okay.
That's all right. How's that, Bob? Oh, you there, Bob? You hear me all right?
Is it still, it's still really small?
Yeah, that's really strange. That might be really small. I'll try that a little. Anyway.
Do you wanna pick up the
handheld
mic?
All right. How's that, Bob? Okay. I just wanted to, there was something you said in the talk that kind of resonated with me personally when you were talking about the community karma, you know, the community, the communal, the impacts of our actions on others and whether we're still around or not, and to the degree that they still impact other people. And, I have a younger brother who he's still alive, but I haven't had contact with him in years. And he's done some very bad things. He spent time in prison and, you know, hurt my family, hurt me personally many, many years ago. But so that just really, you know, the residual impacts of his hungry ghost actions, like the things that got him in trouble, were very much that kind of reaching for something that he was never going to be satisfied to get. So I appreciated that comment. That really opened up something for me. So thank you.
And there's a, I guess there's a aspect of Buddhism that is a little, because we're not just saying, like, I don't know, if you just pray, you'll go to a heaven and it'll all be good. Saying, you know, this is the way life is. And fortunately, with our practice, we have ways to be at peace and find some happiness in the midst of it. And it's not fair. I mean, you know, at least if you could blame everything that happens on your own behavior, that's where I feel like that's a big fallacy, because essentially what that is you want to control everything. Because if everything that happens to you is due to something you did in the past, then you can control everything that happens to you in the future based on what you do right now, which I think is pretty silly. Like, okay, what you do right now is very important. The choices you make, practice, etc. But you can't control everything that happens to you in the future. So that's an uncomfortable thing to face. But in particular, that kind of collective karma, and we might realize, like, we, you know, in a sense, I'm hunted by the hungry ghosts of the Afghanis. You know, there's no undoing that and undoing that sense of, like, culpability for it. And so we're gonna have ghosts. we're gonna have ghosts around. And how can we just be with that and practice with that and not, yeah, you can't undo what your brother did. It's in this lifetime, it's hard to even get your mind around how could that be resolved? You can't, even if he suddenly was like a loving, wonderful person and yet became wonderful friends again, there's still stuff that just cannot be undone. Karen.
Yeah, this was really interesting for me because I read a book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. And I didn't relate it at all to Buddhism, but it's a story, it's a nonfiction written by a medical doctor in Canada who suffers from a shopping addiction. And he has started this whole community up in Canada. I think it's called Portland. The city's called Portland, and I'm not sure what area of Canada. But it's a community where addicts can just live and, you know, live with their addiction, and they have medical care and psychological care and food. And, you know, they're sort of provided for in this communal living situation. And it seems to be really successful. And one of my oldest son has addiction, and while he's, I believe, doing pretty good right now, it has helped him hugely to have a family around him who's been supportive and, you know, not judging, you know, what life brought him. And so anyway, it's been a really interesting talk. And and when you have somebody in your life that you're, you know, love, that has addiction, it can't help but affect you. You know, I don't think anybody can live side by side with somebody and not just witness the self-destruction and just the pain that they're going through and not be affected by it. So anyway, really interesting morning for me. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great reminder that that's one of the primary, like, so I have a couple podcast episodes that are about the six realms, and in particular, like, how, you know, what does this mean to our lives? So I described the imagery like I did, but also like, well, what, you know, what might this look like in real life? What might this look like in the world, in our own experience? And addictions are definitely like at the classic hungry ghost realm phenomenon. And I just love that kind of the mythology expresses so much when, you know, the very fact that you could go to the hungry ghost realm, you could see what is happening there, and you could offer them something, and like, it's not going to help. They can't take it in. So what can you do? All you can do is maintain proper boundaries and try to be as patient and compassionate as possible. And I think that's an amazing thing to be portrayed in this mythology, something that is so real. Betty.
Myself. Yeah, thank you for this talk. It's really helpful. So you mentioned that, you know, during Zazen, one could open the gates and sort of let the ghosts come on in. And so that's very timely because I tried that a little bit last night, and it was just not as much fun as I thought it would be, obviously. But yeah, so that's a little scary to do that. But some of the ghosts, not many, fortunately, are related to or represent past mistakes that I have made in relationships with people that are still in my life. And it would be harmful to them, hurtful to them, to go there with them now. So I need to find a way to forgive myself or to make peace with the ghost that haunts me so that I can learn from it and move on. But that's hard. That's hard to do. And I don't really know, you know, what the next step would be once I sit with the ghost a while and have conversations about this with my ghosts. You know, where do I go from there?
And I think we don't know. It feels like it's going to be different for every single situation. You know, that's where, and sometimes we don't even, until we open up to it and sit with it for a while, we don't even know what's really wrong. like my example of, I wasn't walking, you know, in the Tsujiki ceremony thinking, I'm so sad and hurt by my family. What I really, just, you know, oh, something will just become clear sometimes about, oh, what, and I guess just in terms of practice, I think about when facing this kind of sticky karma, which we can talk about it as ghosts. Sometimes I think about it as like we've made karmic knots. You know, it's just, it got very complicated. And now we have this knot and it's not easy to untangle. And so there it is. Just to mix a lot of metaphors here. Sometimes I feel like you know, you sit and you want to try to like get to the bottom of this, but it's just, it's not working. So then to mix metaphors, I feel like you just put it on the back burner. You just put it on the back burner for a while and not forget about it. You know, not forget about those mistakes that you made and that whatever, but just realizing right now it's not becoming clear to me how to deal with this. So also not fretting over it too much, I guess. Jane.
Thank you. I really appreciated your presentation and your comments. I have one area of confusion. I'm looking for some edification. Dogen says that we only practice in this moment. Our practice only goes in one direction, forward. What is the efficacy of inviting in entities from a past that no longer exists?
Well, the essence of it is that it's not about the past. It's about what is right here because of the past. So in a sense, when we're inviting, you know, the ghosts or whatever, what we're actually doing is opening up to our full experience. And so the ghost, it lives in us right now. If it didn't live in us right now, it wouldn't be a problem. So that, you know, it really is what is here right now. I still feel a tightness. When I think of this, I still get reactive. It's living in us still. Does that make sense?
Hello.
Is it on? You gotta turn the switch to the red.
Hello, guys. I had a tormenting relationship with my mother. And it's funny because she wanted me to be perfect in every single thing I did, from my education to the way I behave, to the way I treated her, to the way I live my life. And the pressure was enormous. When she passed away, it still lingered heavily. When I entered Buddhism, I thought about all the things that I wasn't perfect in front of her. And that haunted me as well, that I didn't do good enough by her. But then, like what Domino said, I just kind of sat with it, not really pushing it, and not really reminding myself of it or beating myself off of it, more like just sitting with it. And then I realized, almost like gradually, or I don't know, effervescently, I guess, I let go of being perfect. And that's it. So if Mom's here today, I'm fine. Bye-bye.
And maybe wherever her energy is, is more understanding, like her grandfather's was, you know. Maybe she's in a place where she goes, oh, I get it, yeah. But in another sense, that's like, even if it was caused by your mom, there was a hungry ghost in you searching for perfection, because that's going to make everything okay, which, you know, you're never going to get it, right? You're never going to reach it. So then you're always, always unsatisfied. So that kind of being satisfied with what we have. So you freed a hungry ghost. And then Jinryu.
I also had a difficult relationship with both of my parents. And when I came into Buddhism, even though they were dead, I still had it. I had an ongoing difficult relationship with them both. And this whole mythology and these whole spiritual ideas that, you know, a concrete thinker has a hard time getting their head around. What I heard a lot when I was brand new was that I was sitting with my ancestors, went to a session and Norman Fisher talked about it, went to Rohatsu and Hogan and Chosen talked about, I'm sitting here with my ancestors, which I really appreciate. You know, because I liked the idea of sitting the way Dogen did, or sitting the way Bodhidharma did. You know, I'm doing exactly what they used to do. But then I also had to be aware of that my parents were here as well. And there's a lot of discussion, a lot of writing going on today about individual trauma and family trauma and cultural trauma, like how the Afghani children are going to grow up and so forth. And my practice, when I'm really trying to understand something is to, or someone, is to just try and figure out why. Why did they treat me the way they did? Why did they say the things they said? And the more I understood, the more I dug into why, the more I understood their trauma, which I don't know if it's a synonym, but I would call it karma. And then I thought about their parents and I began to understand their trauma. And so this tension between me and their spirits really began to fade away. And I'm not saying that it doesn't come back every now and then, but it's momentary. And I, you know, just overall, my practice has really helped with a lot of that tension surrounding the past and people from the past.
Thank you. Well, we're just about at our wrapping up time. All right. Brian, we got a minute.
So you turn around and you face your ghost or ghosts. And What do you say to it? What do you do to it? And so I happened to be reading this fascinating book called Good Genes about mothering practices. And it turns out that rats actually replicate poor mothering that they have gotten over time. But they also replicate good mothering that they had over time. And it turns out that rats who've had bad mothering, if there's an intervention and they get some good mothering, they in turn become good mother rats. So obviously if you have a rat problem, this is something to think about, but even if you don't, and you're just turning around on your ghost, maybe the thing you do to it or with it is just vow not to replicate it, to know that it has been given to you in some form or fashion. And then you have the choice, perhaps to some degree, to limit the degree to which you replicate the injury or the damage. And that's a lot. So.
Yeah. Very much. Thank you. It's a nice note to end on. All right. abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Parami. All right, thank you everybody for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.